You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 94 is something like, what are the best habits of reading, writing, and thinking? We read three related essays from Arthur Schopenhauer, published in 1851, on authorship and style, on thinking for oneself, and on genius. You can join the discussion, get the texts, and loads more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linton-Meyer speaking to you from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Alwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Anybody that was expecting us to be talking about Robert Nozick, sorry, that episode for the first time in the history of the podcast was destroyed by an aged hard drive that ground the episode to dust. But that will never happen again. And we're going to redo that one in July. So, sorry, libertarians, you're going to have to wait a little longer, but that's the way the market works. Why don't you just get it from another source?
Isn't it more like an act of God or a failure of physics or something?
I'm just saying, we're not selling peas here.
Or pins.
Ground rules for our discussion include try not to assume that our audience has read what we're talking about or has any other background in philosophy. Number two, don't make arguments that hinge on something other than what we've agreed to read. This is going to be hard for me today, but I will try. Don't say, you would know what I was talking about if only you'd read Galen and Palin, A Strawsonian Tale of Love and Bondage. Number three, we will be rigorous and exact in all that we say unless doing otherwise would be potentially more entertaining. So, Seth is on his honeymoon.
Yes.
Sorry, ladies. He's going to Thailand. Let's give his address. Share other personal details. So, Schopenhauer.
Yep.
So, this is the first time I've ever read Schopenhauer.
Awesome. This seems like a nice little introduction. It doesn't require any knowledge of his Kantian weirdness, of his system. It's just an interesting article. Well, Wes, you had recommended that we read this on authorship and style essay. Where did you hear about this?
At Brain Pickings. That's the blog by Maria Popova, I think. She put up a post, 19th century German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer presages the economics and ethics of the web and modern publishing. Basically saying you're all dipshits.
So it was, yeah, similar to a post that you had done for us, Wes, about how academic publishers should just stop it. They're contributing to a landfill of waste.
Well, yeah, I was just quoting some other article and I came up with a pithy title for the post. Yeah, the publisher parish landfill, I called it. So that's one type of writing that he criticizes in this, at various points in these three essays. I mean, there's the, he goes after popular writing. So at some points I was thinking of Sam Harris and those types of people, the popularizers who haven't really done much thinking. And then the scholars who spend their lives thinking about, well, how did Schopenhauer influence Nietzsche instead of actually thinking about the philosophical problems they were engaged with?
Or people who are overly concerned with the biographies of the people.
Yeah.
So as I got more into this, I was like, oh, well, clearly he's just pissed off that he was being overlooked in favor of Hegel and other people like that. And it's hard not to do that, particularly given Schopenhauer's association with Nietzsche and Nietzsche making that a point of pride, that that's not irrelevant considering the biography. It's getting at the psychology of the people involved. In fact, for Nietzsche at times, according to some of his aphorisms, seem to explain the whole of their philosophy, what kind of person they are, more or less determines in a nearly mechanical way what kind of philosophy they will produce.
Right. But it's unclear that Nietzsche would be interested in the sort of an academic approach to that, because that is, you take an English department or something, instead of focusing on, let's say, the aesthetics, you know, there was a time actually, and this was called New Criticism in the middle of the 20th century, and it was considered a type of formalism where you would focus on the form of some poem or some work of literature, and you would analyze that and try and block out biography. In some ways, St. John's is sort of predicated on this approach, right? We don't do any secondary reading or we don't read much about the authors we're reading about. We just sort of enter into the text and treat them as part of a dialogue and we think about those ideas. So coming back to the whole biographical approach, I mean, if you remember your literature courses from college or high school, it does seem to become a kind of evasion where some Shakespeare scholar is up there talking about customs and Renaissance England, as opposed to talking about Shakespeare, the play specifically. So I sympathize with Schopenhauer on that one. I think there is a lot of evasion because it's the harder work is in analyzing the text as a text. The close reading approach is the least easy approach, and the easiest way to approach a text is as a bit of sociological evidence or historical evidence, and there are types of criticism that tend in that direction. So I wonder what Nietzsche, you know, Nietzsche, arguably he was interested in sociology, right, and in biography and psychology, but I wonder if he would like the spirit of academic approaches that use that, say what I think it's called new historicism today. It's very attuned to the historical and biographical circumstances surrounding the literature. I think Nietzsche might think there's a blandness to all of that.
It seems the real detriment in those cases is often the tendency to oversimplify and extract out of the work sort of any effect of the author. There's a funny kind of move to what's the causal nature of the work and root it in the time and the biography and the circumstance of the author, as if it just grew out of that without any activity of the author themselves.
Right. Or any acknowledgement that the author, you know, it might have survived because he's in some important sense an exception to those times, right? You know, of course, in a way they are a product. Of course, you can look at Marlowe and Shakespeare and see similarities, but then of course there are important senses in which Shakespeare is preeminently a not Marlowe, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you're putting into focus Schopenhauer's thesis throughout these essays is that genius is real, that the works of a great thinker are not the products of the time. They're the products of hard, difficult thought by someone who isolates himself from the mainstream, who is able to stop parroting the words of others. Obviously, everybody has influences, but don't have so many influences that it overwhelms you. Read only insofar as your thinking sort of remains master when you're encountering a text. So it's fine to bounce ideas off of other people or use other people's writings to inspire you, but that's not the same thing at all as being a scholar. Very similar to a great artist, a great writer of any sort of philosophy is going to be somebody who is primarily a solitary thinker.
Yep.
And his disdain for scholarship is really deep, that the notion that you are engaging in fruitful thinking by having the primary goal, sorting out what Nietzsche thought about Plato or something like that. I wonder in some cases if he would consider that activity equivalent to good reading, if it was the right sort of analysis. But at the end, even if you were trying to sort out what Nietzsche thought about Plato, that would still pale in comparison to thinking through the things that they were thinking through in the first place.
This was actually one of the benefits, I think, of St. John's. I mean, it's a drawback too, which we can get to, but so we are given the Critique of Pure Reason at some point.
Spring of junior year.
That's right. And I actually spent my spring break studying the Critique of Pure Reason instead of doing anything fun. So I was immediately enamored of that book, but I didn't understand it. So I remember I would read the first paragraph of the Transcendental Aesthetic, and then I would take a walk and I would just think about it. That happened a lot at St. John's. So it never even occurred to me to rush to find some piece of secondary literature that had been written about it. And of course, I did learn to do that in grad school. And I noticed the difference, which is that it's the very kind of thing that Schopenhauer talks about in these essays. I got to understand Kant by trying to retrace his steps, trying to redo what he was doing by thinking about the same problems, and then having an aha moment where I thought, okay, now I understand what he's getting at. But another case is in grad school where I was just reading secondary literature. It was far quicker. And in some ways, it felt like less of a waste of time. Like, okay, I spent all that time thinking about Kant and trying to reinvent the wheel in some sense, going through it the hard way. But of course, my understanding of Kant was much deeper for that. And that is one of the points Schopenhauer makes here. You can pick up a piece of secondary literature and kind of ramp up on something very quickly, but that's much different than understanding an author because you've thought through some of the very same problems.
Reading the Schopenhauer just reminded me of thinking about the whole business of reinventing the wheel and how even becoming good at anything, but maybe in particular thinking through hard things and becoming good at that activity of thinking requires a significant amount of reinventing the wheel. And there are times when I would read secondary literature where I would feel just like what Wes described, that you would have a kind of efficiency. And with somebody who did a really good job, you would have the benefit of a distillation that really resonated with the work itself. But it was often really hard to judge that unless you had read the work in the first place.
Right.
So I would have the experience of reading some secondary literature long after having read through the primary text and then thinking, oh, well, that really did a good job, and getting new insights out of it. But then I would maybe read some secondary literature that was in concert with the work that I was reading, and I would feel like it was good, but I guess if I was conscious, I would try to doubt that judgment because I didn't have any basis for doing it. And it can be hard to slice that because, you know, in grad school, you end up surfing along on the secondary literature, not just in terms of understanding, but in terms of what you're actually talking about. Like some of the times we've read articles that have been fairly recent philosophical articles, I just get completely dismayed at like the plethora of footnotes and attributions where there's a kind of attempt to maintain coverage about, you know, who thought of this and where did I get this information? And it's clearly because of the academy and the way the academy works that, you know, people's careers are at stake with those kinds of things. And ecology, the academy, requires that people talk about each other.
Right.
But it very quickly descends into a kind of conversation about conversations about conversations, you know, a kind of philosophical court rather than trying to actually think through something. Then the same thing happens in physics, actually, where you end up having problems or measurements that are done just because they're, you know, they're sort of the next thing to do. And sometimes you can see the justification in it, in that you're building up this sort of edifice of information that is just kind of a giant encyclopedia that then acts as the basis for future work. I'm not sure that that works quite the same way in literary criticism or philosophy, though.
So a recent analytic philosophy paper that we read, that one by Nick Bostrom on transhumanism, that we had a lot of complaints about. But among those complaints is not necessarily that the main point was confused by all the references, that the references did make it a little tedious. It did mean that he was responding to arguments that wouldn't have occurred to me. And so in that sense, not having a conversation with the reader so much as with the literature. But analytic philosophy has taken to heart, I think, Schopenhauer's recommendation to use everyday language, be as simple as possible. No matter how deep your thoughts are, you should think them out enough that you can express them in ordinary English, ordinary German, whatever. And in fact, do it from a variety of different standpoints that you can kind of return. And I saw, you know, in these different essays that Schopenhauer wrote, he's treating basically the same topic, but he's approaching it from different sides. So we see it in action, that in the first one on authorship, he's talking about being a writer and what motivates him as a writer, what he admires and doesn't admire in writers. But then the On Thinking for Himself, he's talking about more being a reader. And obviously those are really closely related. The writer presumably is reading things and that's influencing his thinking. And then the On Genius one, that's exploring the ideal for being a thinker, that even though, well, it's pretty obvious that he thinks himself among the geniuses, but still, the way it's written out is the first two articles could be general advice for anybody who wants to be a thinker, who wants to be a reader, who wants to be a writer. Whereas an On Genius, yes, so geniuses are so rare. So there are certain things about being a genius that you're not going to be able to just imitate. I mean, it's a matter of having a certain very exceptional nature. But I just thought it was interesting how those essays, and then there are other related ones that are on the websites that we linked for these essays. You can see these have been packaged later in a book called The Art of Literature. And so it's a bunch of things, but they give a really good picture of this, how to really thoroughly thought out subject. So it's like a comedian that can develop the same bit in several different ways.
My favorite one to think about was On Style. Mm-hmm. And I actually got a copy of that collection, The Art of Literature, and the essay on authorship and style was broken up into two separate essays, on authorship and on mm-hmm. style. So I guess it's sort of the second section of the on authorship and style. What resonated to me was him trying to work through an articulation of authenticity. And this essay, he's clearly focused on style in terms of writing. I expect you could extrapolate it a little bit more of style in terms of a way of being. But besides having sort of particular virtues of good writing, one of them is your own voice, your own authentic way in which you think and the way in which you are. And he doesn't talk a lot about how that gets developed, but just more towards what it looks like and its virtues. And it reminded me of Nietzsche, it reminded me of Sartre. And I wondered what you guys thought about that.
Yeah, there's a great line, actually, the styles of physiognomy of the mind.
Yeah, it's the first line of my essay, yeah.
Okay, yeah. In ours, it just flows through. But yeah, it's it is a more reliable key to character than the physiognomy of the body.
Yep.
To imitate another person's styles, like wearing a mask, and so on and so forth. Affectation in styles, like making grimaces.
Yep.
So yeah, I think you're right. It is about authenticity, ultimately. And for Nietzsche, style was something, I think, highly individual, as in something like a fingerprint.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why that was important for Nietzsche is because, say, in Aristotelian virtue ethics, where you say, okay, based on human nature, we're going to say what's good. But for Nietzsche, that good can vary from individual to individual, depending on that style, basically, that fingerprint. But ultimately, it's characterological. It's about character, just like it is in Aristotle, except that every character, again, is unique and has a unique implications for one's values and one's good.
And in the next paragraph, when Schopenhauer says, a man's style shows the formal nature of all of his thoughts, the formal nature which can never change, be the subject or the character of his thought what it may, it is, as it were, the dough out of which all the contents of his mind are kneaded. So that's the kind of talking to me that means that he thinks of it as a person's being.
I just want to clarify. So when he says formal nature there, he doesn't mean, you know, this is the fancy, the dress nature or something like that. He's talking about matter versus form.
Yeah.
So that he talks about earlier, you know, a book can never be more than the impression of its author's thoughts. The value of these thoughts lies either in the matter about which he has thought or the form in which he develops his matter. That is to say, what he has thought about it. So he then goes on to say that a lot of books are just interesting because they're about some matter that's interesting. And that's what the public is most interested in. So if you go and you travel somewhere unusual and you write about their customs, then it's fine if you're very utilitarian in how you're describing it, because you just want to get the information. But when you're writing about the everyday, so if you're reflecting on life itself, you're reflecting on really the common experience of everybody, you sure as hell better have had some original thoughts. You better have a distinct style, or that's not going to be a worthwhile thing to read.
Yeah.
I would think you would distinguish, though, the original thoughts and the distinct style, and in general, prefer the distinct style, that is, that authentic voice, to the original thoughts. And he would judge the person who has an authenticity to their writing as having an extraordinarily important virtue of thinking and being a human being, but not, you know, be a genius. So someone who it might be at some level worth spending time with, but maybe not a lot of time with. He would, you know, rank them below the person who had original thoughts and an authentic voice.
I don't know that just from that sentence that I just read, or the form in which he develops his matter, that is to say, what he has thought about it. I don't think he distinguishes those. So he talks about someone's style, as you say, that they have a good conversational style. It's not that they have pleasant word choice. That's part of it. But being very felicitous in your word choice is going to be part and parcel of having original thoughts. And I guess the best comparison I can make is for a comedian. That is, a comedian who has interesting original stuff to say is going to be the same comedian that is sort of most entertaining about it, I think, as far as Schopenhauer would be concerned.
Well, also, he associates style and conversation with wit, right? And that's about being able to quickly make these connections. And there is something formal about that, right? So I might not necessarily know about some topic being discussed, but if I'm witty and smart, I can quickly pick up what I need to know and I can make interesting connections. Now, if I were writing about it, I could make interesting connections, but as a wit in a conversation, I might just make funny, interesting connections to make people laugh or something like that.
It's your perspective that you're bringing. It's the fact that your perspective is interesting, a term that he would not use.
But I'm trying to support your contention, Mark, that there's this association between style and ability to think originally. And in the case of conversation, it becomes thinking on your feet.
Well, I think that he makes that association, and well, I guess he assumes that every authentic voice will generate unique thoughts. So in that way, he would go along the direction of the kind of uniqueness of each individual style and character. So insofar as it is authentic and individual, that will of necessity result in unique thinking. And maybe for Schopenhauer, the category of an authentic voice that is not necessarily unique doesn't exist. I guess I took him in some other parts to be allowing for that possibility. When he talks about certain kinds of serviceable writers,
mm-hmm.
and he contrasts people who seem to be clearly putting on airs with people who are maybe simple, but authentic.
Right. Naivete, he says, is great
yep.
in a writer.
But that cuts in a different way, and I didn't want to bring that part up right yet. Maybe it is as simple as naivete, that he would appreciate the person who authentically tried to think through something on their own, even if the conclusion they came to, everybody of any sort of learning already knew. He would hold them in higher esteem. I guess that's all I mean. In that paragraph on naivete, he says, "That is why it is praise to an author to say that he is naive. It means that he need not shrink from showing himself as he is. Generally speaking, to be naive is to be attractive, while lack of naturalness is everywhere repulsive. As a matter of fact, we find that every great writer tries to express his thoughts as purely, clearly, definitely, and shortly as possible. Simplicity has always been held as a mark of truth. It is also a mark of genius. Style receives its beauty from the thought it expresses, but with the sham thinkers, the thoughts are supposed to be fine because of the style. Style is nothing but the mere silhouette of thought. An obscure or bad style means a dull or confused brain." And so that paragraph, when he starts talking about style at the end, it becomes clear that there's a good style and bad style, right? It's just the formal nature of his thought, and that he needs mm-hmm. to qualify what the characteristics of a good style are, which in this case, it's marked with simplicity and naivete and stuff.
Yeah, characterizing the good style, he says, "Hence the first rule, nay, this in itself is almost sufficient for a good style, is this, that the author should have something to say. Ah, this implies a great deal." This reminds me of Nietzsche, by the way, his style right now, actually.
Nietzsche's not so original, is he?
But of course, Nietzsche did something different with it. But.
Well, but something to say is not necessarily something original, right? This goes to the question of authenticity. And I agree that he wants to say that all original thought has its source in authenticity.
Yeah, I think you're right in the sense that it's the anxiety of being original which drives people to make sure they've read every bit of secondary literature and footnoted it to make sure that someone hasn't had the same insight before them.
That's not naive. Right. That's the wrong way.
The naive way and the better way is just to say, like, it's back to reinventing the wheel. Fuck it. I'm not going to let someone else steal my joy. And if someone else has had this insight before, fine. And hopefully I can actually say it in a better way anyway, if I'm that arrogant. But also what he identifies here and part of the authenticity and naivete is the urge to actually communicate something. So if you look at a lot of secondary literature, especially in the humanities, it's very obvious that there is no desire to actually communicate something. In fact, the person is under duress. They don't really have anything to communicate, but they have to. It's their job, their tenureship or whatever depends on it. And the other thing they do is they try to intimidate. They use lots of big words. They try and show themselves to be formidable in some sense, intellectually formidable. And of course, anyone with a decent education in the humanities immediately knows that these people are full of shit, that they have anything but a formidable intellect. So that huffing and puffing is the first sign that there's not really much there behind the curtain.
I need to bring in a point that he makes in On Genius that I think would focus this discussion of originality, that he seems to think that intellectual knowledge is getting at something universal. So there's a quote here that says, "A genius is a man in whose mind the world is presented as an object is presented in a mirror, but with a degree more of clearness and a greater distinction of outline than is attained by ordinary people." So that's related to larger points in his epistemology where, insofar as we are ordinary, willing people acting out on our desires, we're acting out of illusion, that everything that sort of separates us from each other and makes us conflict with each other is, just like a Buddhist would think, is a matter of the phenomenal world being illusory. But when we transcend that and think intellectually, then we're getting at something universal. And so really anybody who's really thinking clearly is probably going to get at some perennial truths. So like you're saying, Wes, if you're writing naively and you say something that somebody else has said before, great. That just probably means that you're getting at a truth that you would very much expect people in very disparate historical times and places to have discovered. So what would make a good style then? Is it original thought? Well, the particular words in which you use is original and your perspective on it is original, but it's not going to be a fundamentally original discovery, right? Because there's almost no such thing as that. There's just people who are really perceptive that can get at the truth of the world in their own unique way. And those that wallow around in blindness, not really discerning what's going on.
Right. And part of it is a fear to think for oneself because, again, so many formidable people have done that thinking already. So why do it? Or am I good enough? Am I wasting my time? Those sorts of considerations, which is precisely the damage that that kind of attitude can do.
I feel like I should throw a flag on the play, Mark.
I tried to keep it to what's in On Genius.
Okay, Dylan, Seth.
Maybe I wasn't successful.
You were not successful.
What did he do?
You brought in Buddhism and the will and the pessimistic epistemology of Schopenhauer.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Mark. I don't read secondary literature.
I read a quote from the actual essay that we read. That's the core of what I wanted to communicate.
You use that as bait, man.
Let me read another sentence from two paragraphs earlier. That purely intellectual life of the individual had this counterpart in humanity as a whole. For there, too, the real life is the life of the will, both of the empirical and the transcendental meaning of the word. The purely intellectual life of humanity lies in its effort to increase knowledge by means of the sciences, its desire to perfect the arts. Both science and thus art advance slowly from one generation to another and grow with the centuries. Every race, as it hurries by, furnishing its contribution. This intellectual life, like some gift from heaven, hovers over the stir and movement of the world. Where it is, as it were, a sweet-scented air developed out of the ferment itself, the real life of mankind, dominated by will, and side by side with the history of nations, the history of philosophy, science and art, takes its innocent and bloodless way. So, in other words, the kind of stuff that we read about in the newspaper and what are the Democrats and the Republicans arguing about today, that's an outgrowth of this shallow life of the will. It's talking, but it's not intellectual. It's referring ultimately to people's interests, their financial interests, their desires. When you're talking about science, and he's still at the point in history where there's not any kind of sharp distinction between science and philosophy. It's all just science as systematic knowledge, you know, truth. And art is part and parcel of it, right? Art is investigating truths in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's enough of a distinction between the natural sciences, right, and science in general at that point. But people aren't so sour on thinking of scholarship in the humanities in general as a science. So, yeah.
Right. Well, and, you know, there's this whole aspersion that Schopenhauer is good ammunition against philosophy as being not practical. And I think even when you're doing science in Schopenhauer's time, you're not necessarily thinking, oh, I want to get something that can be translated into a technology, right, or a medicine, right, or a life-saving, whatever. It's still knowledge for knowledge's sake, fundamentally. It's great if things come out of it, but, you know, maybe it wasn't so easy to create, to patent an invention and get it out to market and change people's lives back then. So right.
The scientists aren't all working for pharmaceutical companies yet.
Exactly. So he saw the intellectual life as this gift, as this superstructure that floats above the practical fightings here and there. So just the paragraph before this. Goethe, during the war in Champagne, amid all the bustle of the camp, he made observations for his theory of color. And as soon as the numberless calamities of that war allowed of his retiring for a short time to the fortress of Luxembourg, he took up the manuscript of his Farbenlehre. This is an example which we, the salt of the earth, should endeavor to follow by never letting anything disturb us in the pursuit of our intellectual life, however much the storm of the world may invade and agitate our personal environment. So thinking is like a heavenly platonic form kind of world that we can retreat to, participate in.
And a source of freedom, I think.
Yes. Freedom from our selfish...
From desires, from heteronomy, right?
And an excuse, if you're good enough at it, if you're a genius, why you should be able to disavow responsibilities like marriage.
Right. And avoid jobs.
So I'll explain this to my wife. And, oh, I really...
You have to convince her you're a genius, which would require you having some genius.
She'll say, you have successfully proven that, like Schopenhauer, you are an asshole.
There's a very fine line between being a genius and being an asshole. Actually, I think Schopenhauer says, yeah, it's okay for you to be an asshole if you're a genius, right?
You can be arrogant. You should be arrogant. That's boldness.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of what I think is polarizing and interesting, that there's something attractive about the model of thinking and about intellectual independence that he outlines here. But at the same time, if you act like this, you're a jackass. And you got to just ask yourself, is that okay that I'm being a jackass?
Well, it's the same sort of dilemma, you know, that we get with Nietzsche, right? So it's lots of great insights. But then at a certain point, the elitism becomes a problem, because how do you tell if you're a genius? There are lots of people who are attracted to, say, Nietzsche, for instance, who are attracted to it, I think, probably because they think of themselves as exceptional when they're not.
And there's no way to test. You can't ask your contemporaries if you're a genius or not, because Schopenhauer says, if you're a genius, your contemporaries are not going to get it. Even the scholars of your time, the smart men of learning, are going to think that, you know, a genius is something that is best after it is killed and stuffed. And then we can, as scholars, feast upon study
it. So you may think you're a genius, but there's a 99% chance you're just a crank.
Nietzsche is like Schopenhauer in being kind of acerbic and delighting in pointing out how dumbass so many people are. And in that way, they're sort of delightful to read because they have a very definite voice and way of speaking, and their kind of crankiness can be kind of fun to watch. But I think Schopenhauer is just wrong on that point, that every genius is a crank. That's just not true.
Well, not every genius is a crank. I was saying, like, crank as opposed to genius. Like, a crank would be, you know, one of those people who shows up to St. John's Q&As, you know, and wants to be the eccentric genius, but really they're just eccentric.
I just think the personality characteristic of being a crank is not positively or negatively associated with genius. I think that just if you looked at the distribution of crankiness and looked at the distribution of genius, you'd see that they basically overlap the way they do in the normal population.
So there are a lot of mild-mannered geniuses out there. Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, let's look at why he thinks that these are the same, that he really thinks that to have original thoughts, and we've already sort of given the provisos on what that might mean, that you have to wrench yourself away from the herd in a significant way, in a real way, so that you are spending a lot of time thinking on your own. You're not watching TV. You're not up on what everybody else is up on. You're not in touch with the fashions, and you're going to be unsociable.
But that doesn't mean you're going to be cranky.
So you're saying cranky isn't bad tempered, right?
Yeah.
Because I was using it in a different way. Yeah.
I mean, certainly that's the way I understand Schopenhauer as being bad tempered.
But maybe the question is not whether you're going to be bad tempered, but whether you're going to be eccentric and maybe a little bit of a loner or an outcast. Something like that.
And awkward. He says you're going to fail at everyday tasks. Your head's in the clouds. And so you're not going to be able to, I don't know. And so in some ways he said, well, of course, you know, if you have wit, you're going to be a good conversationalist. So presumably you would impress people at parties, which seems to be the kind of politicking thing that he says in other places that you should not be good at. You should not be able to find your way around the legal system well, or something like that. I don't know. It seems like he says different things. In some places he says, well, you know, if you're really smart, this will show through in everything you do. You should be able to master the simple stuff, intellectual tasks as well, because you're super smart. But on the other hand, your head is in the clouds, and so you're neglecting these other things, and you're going to fail at them.
It just sounds to me a lot like people saying, oh, in order to be a great jazz musician, I have to do heroin. It amounts to an affectation of the kind that I think Schopenhauer is actually criticizing, where you associate certain personality traits with their excellence. So every artist is very difficult to deal with because they so insist on their vision, rather than the fact that they could just as well just be a complete ass. And the fact that they are an ass doesn't mean that they're a genius. And just because they're a genius doesn't mean that they're an ass. And it does make sense that there would be a certain kind of honing of being good at some things and not good at others. But again, I would stipulate that in general, people, to the extent that they're excellent at something, aren't excellent at other things. Most people that I talk to, you know, they don't know at all how their car works and how to fix their car. And they'll take their car in to get windshield wipers put on. I would never in a million years think of doing that. But that doesn't make me a genius or something. Do you know what I mean?
It means you're not a genius, because if you were a genius, you would know how to do it. You'd be thinking about deep troubles.
Go, Mark. That's perfect. That's exactly right.
Yeah, no, you're channeling Persig. Persig was obviously a genius, but he knew how to fix his damn motorcycle. Yeah. He didn't understand people that couldn't.
Yeah, guess what? I don't mean to try to change the category of genius. I'm just trying to say that this kind of thing that Schopenhauer is talking about, I think he verges too much onto really conventional ways of understanding the way in which people who have displayed certain kinds of excellences ought to get passes in the way in which they deal with the world. And I guess it's just not clear to me that those things are correlated with their intellect or their contribution. It's not that they shouldn't get passes, but just that there are lots of clumsy, dumb people in the world, just like there are clumsy, smart people in the world. And there are lots of people who can't balance their checkbook. And just because Albert Einstein couldn't balance his checkbook, do you know what I mean?
Well, there is a tension, though, between people who are sort of more focused, for instance, on human relationships, you know, having a spouse and children and friendships, and to the extent that someone is focused on those relationships, those are time-consuming things that can get in the way of being really, really, really good at one thing. Not just having a competence at one thing or another, but just being of a whole different category in some area, really devoting your life to being absolute best at something. So I think he has a point in that sense. There definitely is this tension between, it's a difference between using your libido to attach yourself to others or to enjoy things versus a libido that's more inwardly directed. And you're sort of developing yourself, right? You're developing your own mind. You're living the life of the mind. For instance, in this example, you're developing yourself as an artist. It's a much more self-absorbed way of being in the world.
That I can buy. There's something that sounds right about that. But that's a very broad kind of group of personality characteristics. And a lot of what I read Schopenhauer saying is much more specific than that.
There's a great paragraph. Let us then not be surprised if we find men of genius generally unsociable and repellent. It is not their want of sociability that is to blame. And then he talks about them being like someone who's going on a walk, but they have to rely on nature for entertainment. Because it's not like he's going to get any fulfillment out of chatting with the peasants. And so he prefers a soliloquy to a dialogue and may condescend now and then to talk to people. And then he goes on to say, well, modesty in a great mind would be pleasing to the world, but he sees it as something that would require you to give in to the thoughts and opinions of the multitudes and even the method and style. So he seems to think that there's some sort of association between genius and radical individuality. And to the extent that you enter into the life of the herd and do the things that are required by the herd. And I mean, maybe someone might make an argument, well, you can be modest and you can observe all the customs of the world and live that way and yet still secretly be a genius, let's say. But I think maybe he thinks there'd be like an eroding effect to that. You simply couldn't sustain your genius and your individuality if you did that.
Right. He definitely thinks thought needs cultivation, that it's not just a matter of raw talent, that it has to be nurtured. I don't know if you could do that, according to him, if you were secret about it. If you were just going through the motions and you had a normal job and you gave your mind to your job, the required amount, and gave your mind and your time to your family and did all that stuff, that you could still fit in there in the hour and a half that you would scrawl down something every night, or better yet for him, the hour and 15 minutes that you would think about it and then 15 minutes that you would scrawl down.
Right. Yeah. And then he talks about the arrogance. I think you already mentioned this, Mark, but the no one becomes great without arrogance of this sort. That is the sort of arrogance in which you disregard the opinions of your contemporaries. So I don't know.
There's a little more reasonable sounding paragraph about the downside of genius a little lower down. But there is always a limit to human capacity, and no one could be a great genius without having some decidedly weak side. It may be some intellectual narrowness. In other words, there will be some faculty in which he is now and then inferior to moderate endowments. It will be a faculty which, if strong, might have been an obstacle to the exercise of the qualities in which he excels. What this weak point is, it will always be hard to define with any accuracy, even in a given case. All right. You know, different philosophers are weak in ways that others are strong. Part of that is, if you're having this original style, then that sort of requires picking a side, picking a focus, picking a point of view, picking priorities, and not just acknowledging the priorities that, again, not just the herd, but all the individuals around you would impress upon you. that we have in this podcast, at least for a couple weeks. We try to let these people's thoughts flow into us and kind of play act, take on those thoughts, really take them seriously. He, you know, especially in the Thinking for Yourself essay, I think would caution against that, that that is a sort of surrendering your mind to those other people for some time. And, you know, I do that because I feel like that is a good exercise. Of course, it's not a permanent thing. Of course, you're not going to completely erase your mind and replace it with Schopenhauer's, but there is some yielding that goes on, and that will, in the long run, make you a well-rounded thinker. And he seems to be saying that if you're really a genius, you can't be a well-rounded thinker. There's going to be blind spots. To excel in one area is to neglect another area by definition.
Mm. That's depressing.
I mean, I think it's the kind of thing that even if you're trying to be Catholic in your taste, you're trying to appreciate all the different sides of everything, it's not going to work anyway. You're still going to have, as long as you're bringing your critical, irreverent approach to all of the different readings you're coming to, then you're building something individual out of these various capacities. So, you know, maybe Schopenhauer would be okay with what we're doing.
Part of that is going to be the way in which it rubs up against unique style or individual style. To the extent that you were good at and processed and were sort of unflappable intellectually, that he would correlate that with a kind of lack of individuality. And then that would translate directly into a lack of originality.
So if you're unflappable, if you're not affected, that would show that you're not really thinking. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yeah.
I was looking over other essays in this tree here. I just read the beginning of all of them. And one of them, in particular, this on education one, like it read just like it could be an Ayn Rand text. The ways he sounds, when he sounds like a crank, it sounds like I've got my point of view and I've developed this over many hard years of observation directly of nature. And I'm not going to let the stupid categories that I inherit from the scholastic environment around me, from the history, I'm not going to let those screw up this delicate creation that I'm putting together myself. But there's a bullheaded side to that in which you are not actually honestly intellectually engaging yourself because you're not challenging yourself. You're not taking other people's words seriously enough to challenge yourself. And I think actually Schopenhauer would be okay. Maybe he'd be more comfortable going mano a mano with a particular philosopher than with a philosophical culture, right? So it's much different for him to have embraced Kant and taken seriously Kant and read so much of Kant and really letting that infect him. Like that's one genius taking on another, even though sometimes Schopenhauer would say, oh, my whole system is just showing the logical consequence of Kant. He doesn't think that makes him a hack because that's very different than I'm one of the Kantians. And participating in this group effort of developing Kant's formulae.
Fichte and Schelling are the hacks, according to him.
Yes. Maybe the key differentiator is there is, do you really understand what you're talking about? That, you know, just like you were saying, Wes, the way you were taking on Kant is you're trying to rethink this stuff and acquire it honestly. Like you sort of see the result that Kant got it. You might not understand completely where he's coming from. He's using a lot of weird language. He's using this faculty psychology language. But you understand enough to get the questions, and then you can kind of come up with your own version of that. And then when you then go back and read Kant, like, oh, I guess that is kind of what he's saying. And maybe you can more clearly distinguish the ways in which you diverge from Kant, that that's still honest. Whereas if Kant was very obscure to you and you just read the same passage over and over again until you kind of were penetrating slowly into what the words meant, that seems to be exactly the wrong way to be a scholar. In fact, that's maybe why he would think the fact that Kant is not so obscure that you really can figure out what he's talking about with a minimum explanation, where, you know, somebody like Hegel, even if you're a Hegel scholar, you might think it's just a mystery that you're imposing your own views on it when you read it. I guess that's a question I want to ask you, that something I was thinking of when you were giving your example about Kant, Wes. I had a lot of experiences like this when I was reading Sartre or Hegel or something, where I would read a passage and I wouldn't really be sure what he meant by it, and I hadn't read the secondary literature, but then I would go and write on my own.
Yeah.
In a notebook, and I would write something that to me felt very revelatory. And it seems like that's a good way to think for oneself, even though it's exactly what Schopenhauer is saying not to do, right? Schopenhauer is saying that these obscure writers, that you have to do that, that you have to, like, you should just avoid those bastards like the plague.
Well, yeah, he makes that distinction early on between the writers who don't think at all and then the ones who think while they're writing and the ones who have already thought it out before they write. And actually, it's interesting because Kant actually supposedly simply thought for like 12 years before he even started jotting anything down about the Critique of Pure Reason. But I'm not sure if he means that writing is a bad way to do thinking. That's probably what he means. But it could also mean the writing that you put out for publication shouldn't just be a sort of meditation where we get to see how the sausage is made. So I think those are two different things. You understand what I'm saying? It's one thing to say writing in general is a bad way to do your thinking, and that I'm not sure about.
Well, the Philosophical Journal, right, that's not supposed to be what you publish necessarily. He does say you should think before you write.
But I'm wondering if he's saying think before you write something for publication, or...
He doesn't seem to say much of the activity of writing as part of your thinking in terms of, like, journaling or something like that, or using your pen as a way of thinking things out. I mean, I take your point, Wes, as wondering if he means publishing stuff as a writer, and that some writers, they publish stuff in order to think about them rather than publishing something worth reading that they've thought through already.
Yeah, it's a kind of writing where you're doing a thinking through of some problem, but you're not reaching any conclusion. So, you know, one popular way of doing things in analytic philosophy is to set up a bunch of possibilities and then knock them down. But the possibilities aren't really that salient, right? So it just becomes an like they're not really live possibilities, but it gives you something to do if you need to publish a paper. So I'm going to run through all these different. So there's a staleness to that. But I think, you know, if he is making a deeper point about the difference between, you know, like taking a walk and thinking and then actually writing and thinking, I mean, my experience is that those two things are different. And I used to do much more of just the thinking because writing is a more anxiety producing process for me. But lately, I think more by writing, and I find it enormously useful, actually. I find it very clarifying. So if that's what he's saying, I think I disagree with him.
Here's a quote that expresses exactly, I think, the point you're objecting to. A thought only really lives until it has reached the boundary line of words. It then becomes petrified and dies immediately.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think there's something to that. I'm really ambivalent about this.
That's the thing where he's talking about, you know, this sounded like the Wittgenstein point to me, that the really important things aren't sayable. That if you're trying to get at mystical underlying truth, you know, he ultimately thinks, again, when you're writing truth, you're reflecting back reality. And he has this ontology by which if you look within yourself, you can kind of see everything. The whole world is within you. All the deep truths are accessible to phenomenological reflection. Although, of course, he didn't call it that. So there's a certain way in which every time you write it down, you're going to not quite capture. It's exactly the point we were making in the Bergson discussion, that when you're doing this metaphysical reflection, according to Bergson, you are getting inside the thing that you're contemplating. And then when you write it down, you're kind of taking a snapshot of that, or at best giving an approximation. But language itself does not admit the original source material, your experience that you're trying to then externalize.
My experience has been that more often than not, that attempt to just exercise the thinking without making it tangible by writing it down ends up being a kind of transcendental cop-out, that you feel like somehow you're in touch with the authenticity of it, and you cop out by not trying to clarify it, by writing it down out of, let's be generous, out of an anxiety that you can't quite say the whole thing you're trying to say. And it's actually what I thought was something so rich that I can't quite say all that I wanted to say was really just confusion, and that it wasn't out of clarity that I thought I could say all those things. It was that all those things couldn't be said at once. I've had the same experience with dealing with students, that they will refuse and refuse and refuse to write things down, and they'll just complain over and over and over again about how what they're writing down doesn't manifest what they're thinking. And some of that might be true, but a lot of it is whether it be talking to them or trying to get through their writer, work through what they've written down and try to link it back to what they were thinking. is that they just weren't very clear and hadn't really completed the thought. I think that that is what most often happens. It'd be like trying to say, I'm going to think through my music and I'm going to think through that melody, but I'm never going to play it. It will be the most perfect melody that exists because I can say it with all the overtones and all the possible timbre and texture that could possibly be rendered, but I'll never, ever play it because that would sully it. And that's how I sort of feel about the notion of just thinking about things and never writing them down.
Well, you've named my next album Transcendental Kappa. Very nice.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you. Entirely the reason to do this kind of podcast is because externalizing it, it's almost really not even a thought at all until you externalize it, I think. And to go back to the Bergson image, yes, if you give one articulation of this fundamental experience, the one articulation is not going to do justice to the experience. Just like to take one picture of the Empire State Building is not going to do justice to the Empire State Building. But the solution to that is not to just take no pictures. It's to take more pictures.
Yes.
Take a lot of fucking pictures and get other people to take pictures and talk about the pictures. And then eventually you can actually retain some of this crap. Whereas if it's just a fleeting moment, I mean, how do you even know that that wasn't just a dream? How do you think you actually got something significant out of this?
And that goes back to the naivete, right? And Schopenhauer doesn't talk a lot about the character or training of one's soul in this respect, you know, the cultivation of these virtues. He just sort of talks about what they are. There is going to have to be a cultivation of naivete for most people. I mean, maybe some people, they're just so unegotistical as to just never worry about such things. And they maintain a constant state of naive earnestness that serves them well in this respect. But I think it's actually something that most people have to train themselves, especially as they get older, to maintain that naivete, both with respect to their peers and social constraints, but even with respect to themselves, displace their own judgment about what they're doing as they go down some new road and not prejudge it and let it unfold. So they have to have, even have a kind of naivete with respect to themselves and allow themselves to make mistakes, allow themselves to just be earnest, even though there might be another part of their mind and their intellect and their history looking over their shoulder saying, why the hell are you doing that for?
So I think it may be kind of a balancing act for Schopenhauer when you write that he would not approve of the kind of just sheer philosophical journal writing of whatever crosses your mind as you're reading another thing. I mean, maybe he has diaries of notes like this, but I don't think so. Well, it's interesting. So this is published in 1851 with a whole lot of other essays. And this, he was still alive. This was the last 10 years of his life. It was actually just when he was getting famous. But I could not find anywhere like when he actually wrote this stuff. And I get the impression just from the sheer number of essays that were published in that collection, in that year, not just the Art of Literature ones, but all these four volumes of just Schopenhauer's essays that you can find on Project Gutenberg, right? You can get them for free. So I have the feeling that what to us might be a philosophical journal, to him was he was writing for posterity. And so it was always a serious thing when he set his pen to paper and he tried to really produce something, like he says, that would be readable, that would be concise, and that required doing a lot of thinking beforehand. Even though, as I said, in these different essays, he obviously was doing some extemporaneous thinking because he was approaching approximately the same topic from another point of view. And in some of the rants he goes on, it's obvious that like he didn't sit down. I think what would be ideal is for me to put another rant about Hegel as this paragraph. That would perfectly illustrate my point.
He's scratching an itch there.
He was spontaneous. Yes. Not too spontaneous. He always felt like, I almost associated with a religious sentiment that even when you're thinking of something or when you're writing, you feel like you have an audience. You feel like God is your audience. You've got to, even though I'm not writing for anybody living, but he sort of had a certain arrogance. And I do sympathize with this. I'll sit down and I want to write something that is just shit. I want to write something purely to work on my craft of writing, get some ideas out. It's really hard to do that. I always have to feel like I'm writing at least like blog post level, or it just won't even happen. It has to be some kind of performance. So I would have to force myself. Maybe this is the naivete you're talking about, like force myself to be really sloppy, just get it out there. And I'm going to turn it into something publishable, I will revise it later, but I just got to get it out. It's hard to be totally free like that. Maybe just got, I have to drink more. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's why writing is so anxiety producing. Your first draft must suck. I mean, it's just putting the clay out on that's going to later get shaped.
When I was taking a fiction writing class, we talked a lot about this stuff. And one guy's strategy was to always write in the morning, literally after he had stumbled out of bed. He would just kind of fall across his apartment and sit down in a chair and just start writing. And it was almost like a sneaking up on his mind to just let it happen. And he didn't have the energy or even the awakeness to castigate himself for how he was writing. And he used that. That was his technique for trying to get over this sort of self-doubt.
It's interesting that he doesn't make a strong distinction between different kinds of writing here, that he sees philosophical writing as on a par with creative work, that I would see it, you know, as quite different if you're trying to explain, even explore a philosophical concept versus writing a short story and letting your imagination run wild, that those are seem different things.
Right. He calls it all, it's all literature. In fact, there's that great line about, I'm speaking here of writers of the higher branches of literature and not of writers of, on the method of distilling brandy.
Yes.
So maybe there's a class of philosophical writers that are comparable to the brandy writers.
Anyway, I thought it was funny. It's like, it's everything but anything that's practical.
I see this naivete very clearly in a lot of the musicians that I've been exposed to / worked with. And it almost reads like he's countering my typical recommendation of urbane acceptance of difference and trying to explore as a listener different styles and get the point of what they're getting and sort of surrender yourself so that you really understand what they're trying to do. That he seems much more in line with the typical good musician who really is only interested in their own music. You know, of course they had some influences that they probably worshipped when they started, but you know, by the time they develop their own style, they're creating something new and they just don't give a shit what anybody has to say about it or whether it's similar in some external way to something that somebody else is doing. And really everything else sucks, that there's no distinction between the rigorous standards of quality that they set to their own material and how they judge other people. I see that as the entire typical musician's attitude. And that seems to be what he's recommending.
Yeah.
And then, so I asked myself as a musician, particularly as a philosopher, has this exercise of giving so much time reading other people, you know, whether you're doing it in the grad school way or whether you're doing it in the PEL way, has that decayed my own ability to produce original thought, you know, produce my own theory that I'm like, well, let us start with the words of the wise and the many, you know, like Aristotle, here's what Schopenhauer thought about it. Here's what blah. And only after I get out five of them would I then articulate my own position, which is some sort of nuanced balance between the bunch. And would that, according to Schopenhauer, is that a mature outcome of thoughtful consideration of a lot of modes of thought? Or is it just because you're so degraded and decayed and really you should just be holed up in your cave, threshing out page after page of the world as will and representation, your own version of that, your own Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance? Is that a concern you share?
What about being unsociable?
No, about no longer having the ability to, you know, if you felt you did in the first place. I certainly felt like at age 19, I had a crapload of original philosophical creative juice. And it would be very hard for me now to write a whole, I don't know, something that I would consider original at this point.
What do you mean by original?
I guess that's the question, is what do we expect? Schopenhauer has given us a pretty vivid picture of what originality consists in. And it could end up being actually, if you think again about these musicians, that, oh, well, they're just doing some kind of punk rock that frickin' there's a million other bands that kind of sound like that, but they have so internalized this and made it like it's their own voice and this is their passion. And if they're a genius, at least it ends up being something historically noteworthy nonetheless.
Goes back to the question of authenticity / earnest, naive sincerity and originality. And I do think that Schopenhauer, in what we've read, equates those things. And you've given the example of musicians in which they are earnest and naive and sincere, but they're definitely not original by any reasonable estimate. And my thought was that Schopenhauer would definitely prefer that attitude and that kind of person to someone who was vainly thrashing about just to become original in just some kind of trivial way. seems to me that he would give a pass, because the examples you're giving, Mark, those guys, they feel like they are being original. They are doing something unique. There's the question of what is the source of their lack of judgment about how unique that is.
My own opinion is that originality is largely illusory, particularly in one of the arts, you know, in music or something. You're acting out styles you've heard, or you're, when there is originality, it's an original synthesis.
Yeah, sure.
So maybe one of the things is maybe you were really influenced by gospel. You went to church all the time and you got all this church music, but then you also got into rock and roll. And so you started playing rock and roll almost like you were in church. And that becomes something that people are like, wow, that is a really interesting take. I've never heard that before. Maybe Johnny Cash is not exactly that synthesis, of course, but is a good example of somebody who had a very distinct voice, very distinct songwriting style, even though as far as the individual musical elements, like you could see where he was getting every individual thing. Again, it's hard to know without like delving into their biography. Like, was the person being original? You know, Bob Dylan was another one that was definitely thought of as like this original young talent, but he was actually even doing a Woody Guthrie impression with his voice. Like, it's almost embarrassing how unoriginal the direct thing that led up to doing what he was doing. And I guess we were just talking about Nietzsche in that respect too, is that so much of what Nietzsche was doing stylistically is channeling Schopenhauer and a couple other folks like that, that he just read to death. It seems like most of the people that we consider original, in some ways, it's just new to us. If we were reading the same stuff that he's reading, well, we would still think he's a very smart, astute observer and stylist and a professional in certain ways that advanced him beyond his years. That even in early stuff Nietzsche wrote or early performances of Bob Dylan, you see something that is pretty remarkable. But authenticity is not the name for it.
Well, wait, originality is not the name for it, right?
Neither of those. Yes.
Well, maybe I misunderstood. I was immediately responding to what you were saying is that, well, there is the authenticity to it, but there's not the originality. Now, you're saying also that someone else might be self-consciously, like Bob Dylan, mimicking or copying Woody Guthrie. I guess the question would be, at what point does he become somehow authentically Bob Dylan, I guess? Might be a slightly different question.
I don't have the same skepticism about originality. Take a band like Led Zeppelin, and some of it's just obviously highly influenced by the blues, and some of it is just covering those songs, but still highly original.
Until you were reading a lot of interviews with them or something and figuring out what they were listening to and how they were channeling it, like, it seems what seems most original to us are often syntheses.
It's pretty well defined. Now we're really talking about music, but like, take a band like Fleetwood Mac, which up to a certain point was just a blues band, and the influence was obvious. There wasn't much being done original with it. And a lot of English, there's tons of English bands doing this, right? They discovered those American blues albums, and there's that renaissance. Even take bands like the, I guess it was the Yardbirds, the New Yardbirds that Jimmy Page started. They still weren't really, you know, there was an interesting elaboration you were getting on it. But when you get bands like The Who, and then later Fleetwood Mac after Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks arrive, and Led Zeppelin, something qualitatively has changed. They have done something. It's alchemical. They've transformed it. And I don't know how to describe it better than
that.
Well,
and you can call it authenticity in that it seems like that they're doing this honest songwriting, whereas imitating the blues. Blues is always a hard case because that is something that the form itself is defined as highly traditional, but yet you're expressing your soul through it. That's kind of the way it's set up. And same with even church music, that there's supposed to be something authentic, even though it's not even trying to be original.
Well, the elements are very simple, you're saying. So it seems like there would be less. But in a way, music is just like that. Music, in a way, it's at bottom simple.
Yeah. Yeah. You're using major chords. Like, a lot of the transitions you're talking about, Fleetwood Mac becoming what it became, was large in part, well, it actually just got catchier songs and,
but it's orchestration. It's things like orchestration. Yeah. Style and originality in music happens in those ineffable areas. It's not that you're going to find some fancy chord in there, some structure like that you can say, ah.
I feel like, Mark, that you are pointing towards a standard of originality that is a kind of uniqueness that it's easy just to say it just doesn't exist. You would even say that about any kind of new or quote-unquote original idea in the sciences or in music. It seems to me they would all fall prey to this.
That's just warmed over Heraclitus.
Yes, yeah, this kind of contextual criticism that, yes, there was a context to that thought, and there were people who had been thinking somewhat similar things, and then maybe you get into a knockdown, drag-out fight of, did Einstein really come up with special relativity, or was it Lorentz, or was it this other guy that read a paper at this unrecorded conference? And it's easy to become kind of preoccupied, to me, with, is it really, really original, or is it just original? And the distinction between it being a quote-unquote unique synthesis and it being original is like a non-distinction to me. I don't even understand how those two things are distinct. And there may be ways in which you could qualitatively talk about degrees of originality, where you would have some way of understanding how unique something was, but it seems like the bar should not be set so high as to be something like, no one's ever heard something like this before.
But isn't that how you, as a kid, you know, if you hear some music that just, this is like nothing I have ever heard before. And then enough people do that. So they say, like, the Beatles, they were just doing this thing that nobody's ever heard. They were, you know, early Pink Floyd, that nobody's ever heard anything like this before. Strawberry Fields, what a freaking... Tomorrow Never Knows, I guess, is the place in the Beatles where they think something completely new is happening. And I understand that as a point of communication, but then confusing that with then saying that casting back in this genius upon the creators as if they were creating something from nothing, I think is just, it's a popular illusion. That what the way you're describing it actually is a very astute, knowledgeable, adult way of seeing the matter. But I don't think that's the way creativity and originality are seen in popular culture.
Those ignorant bastards. Which brings us right back to Schopenhauer.
Well, yes. Okay. So Schopenhauer, you know, like I was saying, if you think that all truth, this is why I was going back and forth between originality and authenticity. I think that's the way Schopenhauer would think, that if you are being authentic, then you're getting back to perennial truths. If you, and that ends up being because you're sort of saying it naively. You're not just parroting back some other thinker or other artist. It's going to come out as originality. Originality in style, originality in exactly what you say, which notes you play, what colors you paint. Precise arrangement of colors you paint, I suppose. I invented a new teal, not the actual elements, though that would be an interesting way of innovating. But that would be hardly the foundation for genius.
That aspect of originality, right, of new colors and stuff, that's where the effect of new technologies and new techniques end up showing up and affecting the development of some art or science and leading to original things.
Which, interestingly, is not something that I think Schopenhauer considers at all, right?
No, not in what we've read.
That he seems to be of the more rustic variety. If really all you need to do is be away from noise and think on your own, and you're going to get a hold of these perennial truths, then having a new kind of synthesizer, that's going to produce a service level imitation of style.
Well, it could, right? I mean, it'll depend on how it gets used, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. If you, actually, it's not just a new synth sound that you're using, but a new whole palette, a new thing that lets you create a synth sound to match your imagination, then you're going to be able to create things that nobody's ever created before. Yeah. No, that seems obviously a way that it happens in real life. And I can't even see why. There were certainly advances in, you know, when you read about the history of painting, and at this point, they discovered depth.
Perspective. Yeah.
Perspective. Every new generation is getting on something novel that then you could express, you know, even if you think it's a perennial truth. I don't know how well that works if you're talking about a picture or a... he definitely thought music, even though not representational, was directly channeling the will itself. That's a different story. Yeah. I mean, I got to think he would dismiss any kind of innovation of that sort as mere surface level chicanery.
Well, again, just the mere fact that you tossed in a Moog synthesizer because it got invented wouldn't be sufficient to make it great. I guess that would be the point. Mm. I forget which essay it was that you were referring to, where he was talking about going to someplace quiet and being outside of the kind of cacophony of modern life, you know, in his, and Schopenhauer's, I was going to say inner crank, but he's clearly got an outer crank, and that, you know, would be complaining in 1851 about how noisy the world is. And it just reminded me of my own reaction, you know, and I've just made my peace with it. But when I go to a coffee shop and I want to have a cup of coffee and read something there, and they always play fucking music, and
yeah,
it's really loud everywhere you go. In fact,
loud music, and it's freezing. Yeah, that's to make sure you won't linger.
Yes, or I'll go to an outdoor mall and they'll be playing music. As you're walking down the street in Annapolis, they had the street, and it wasn't even a mall. It was just a neighborhood with some restaurants and stuff like that. And they had ambient music playing out there. And I almost called up the builder and said, what the fuck are you doing? And at a coffee shop, I don't understand why they feel compelled. Hey man,
you're lucky it's not advertisements projected into your brain directly, because that's the future.
Maybe it is.
You go to the gas station and they get the gas pump and they start sending advertisements to you. Have you been to those gas pumps?
Oh God, I have to actually disobey the law and go inside my car and shut the door and wait for it to be done pumping. I cannot fucking stand that. Oh, I'm going to get this. A static shock is going to blow up the car because I stepped inside or whatever the thing that they think.
Make sure you listen to us. You'll get on your cell phone at the same time
and have a smoke while you're at it.
Yes. Yes.
But that gets at something else. I'm glad you brought that up, that he thinks that the unenlightened, the non-geniuses, that we can't stand our own thoughts, that we're easily bored, and people just, they want to retreat from that. And I certainly see that in myself. From when I was a little kid, I would just hum. I would sing in my head all the time. Like, and I don't know if that would count. Oh, you know, I'm creating it myself. But no, it wasn't like an original composition, I'm sure, for the most part. It was some meme from some song or something that I picked up somewhere. In fact, I think in some ways the line between the things like that we fill our heads with and what we've picked up again is not altogether clear. That one could see that, oh, even as a child, you were a budding composer. But no, I think it's more that's just the way I was comfortable, was having something going in my head.
But there is a real distinction between being active and passive. And people tend to stimulate themselves. In a way, it's about obliterating the mind. So whether it's about having music on all the time or being on a mobile device, that's a way of coping with the anxiety of the fact that, for instance, if there's an intermission, you know, in all that stimulation, inner stimuli might come at you, your own feelings, for instance, things that are more pregnant and more vital and therefore potentially could lead to more joy, but also are more anxiety producing. So you see, there's kind of a hierarchy of gratifications, and at the very bottom, the very basest gratifications, and you could think of them as infantile in a way, like, you know, sticking something into your mouth or to suck on it, like an oral gratification. Those are easy things. Those are regressive. And we can comfort ourselves with food or with, again, putting music on or a mobile device or something like that. But to actually do something creative, you have to push past that barrier of anxiety. It's work that's part of it. You know, it's more of a hybrid kind of thing, and it has pain and pleasure to it. But also, I think, you know, there's a real fear. So at least as with writing, you know, I know a lot about this. The asking myself the question, well, why don't I do more writing when it gives me such joy when I do it? Well, at least now I've gotten a lot more productive with it. But in the past, it was always about all these anxieties. It was easier to surf the web or watch TV or do something else. So those are different forms of gratification. A gratification where you're actually sublimating, you're at this higher level, and one where you're actually trying to obliterate the mind. So one is about, in a way, getting rid of the mind, and one about is being present to the mind and its thoughts and feelings, as present as you possibly can be.
Doing what you really want to do is very hard.
Yeah.
I think you would say there's a difference between stimuli that are thrust on you, like the music that the coffee shop happens to be blaring, and things, it doesn't even have to be something you are generating, that you're humming or something, but that plays nice, that inspires you in some way. So, I mean, I even have a little rule, like if a song is going through my head, I will try to play that and kind of reinforce it. And that there's something very satisfying about that to me that doesn't feel, it's like, this is already the thing that you're juggling and you're just reinforcing it. I don't know if that's healthy. I'm certainly not using it to write original philosophy or something.
Wait, say it again. What is it? It's...
is reinforcing something. Like, I think there's, as far as music goes, it's very good for me with the new technology with Spotify and whatever, being able to have the entire library of everything I've ever heard on my computer that I can stream into my phone, to be able to reinforce something that I find myself humming or something, to amplify that. And that's a very different experience from hearing something on the radio that, you know, I didn't ask for that. Or worse, in a public, in a coffee shop.
See, I have the opposite thing where, like, I miss the days of having CDs on my shelf and being able to browse and sort of have something stand out. And so I put it on. You can sort of do that with mobile devices too, and Spotify, but it's just not the same. There's more seeking involved. There's more choice. And I love having the radio on, where it's just much different when someone else has chosen this for you, as opposed to you figuring out what song to put on.
Well, it's the beauty of selection, right? It's similar to the pleasure of going to the library and actually going to the shelf.
Yeah.
And finding the book that you were looking for, but then browsing around there, because whether it be by the Dewey Decimal System or the brilliance of the librarian, or a good bookstore will do the same thing, is that you benefit from the selection function of the person who put that together. And so it wasn't you, but it becomes shrunken to an amount that is not overwhelming, where you can actually process the information and you can discover something out of it. You can see the tree in the forest. I completely agree with you, Wes, that there's a real pleasure in that. And that is one, the card catalog is, despite all the wonderful aspects of searching through electronic database, I still have not seen anything that brings that virtue of serendipitous discovery.
Yeah, yeah.
That came with a paper card catalog.
Hmm. I've just never heard of an individual in my life that misses paper card catalogs.
Oh, my God. It's not as efficient if you're trying to really maybe search for specific works, but in terms of the pleasure of and the discoveries that come with slowly going through something, unless you get it by going to the bookshelf, but the card catalog has the advantage of having things aligned that are different than the bookshelf does. So you would have things by subject that they would be in wildly different sections of the library, mm-hmm. but they would be aligned together in the subject section. Mm-hmm. And you mm-hmm. would see them. Now, electronically, Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other stores, they're always trying to come up with ways to present you with things that are similar. And it's this kind of selection function that is, at the forefront of what search engines are doing. They're trying to figure out a way to provide a combination of things that you are actually thinking about and serendipitous stuff. And in my experience right now has been that they basically try to come up with copies of what you're doing.
And they also rely on human users. Like, other people have bought this thing that you just looked at. Here's this thing you just looked at is in playlists created by all these people, and show the related bands that we're showing you or whatever are books or ones that are from that pile.
And then it's a perfectly serviceable, way of selecting things, I guess. But I do miss the card catalog in that respect.
I think for Schopenhauer, the important thing is just that it's not haphazard. That the metaphor that I like to think of is that everybody with their intellectual life is doing a juggling act already. And so what would be bad as far as education would be going, that's why it's so tricky to educate, especially young people, is because it's like you're throwing an extra club into what they're doing. That the worst thing you could do is treat them like a tabula rasa, bash down everything that they're doing and say, do this instead. Yeah. That's exactly the way to sort of be alienated from intellectual life and to not think for yourself, that you gotta, wherever you're at with your own thinking and creativity, things have to be fed slowly to you in a way that you can get them, the things that you're ready for. So that requires a very skillful teacher or a computer that is knowledgeable about other things you might like. For me, like musically, the way I did that was I'd never liked the radio, or at least after I really liked it when I was like in sixth grade or something. But when I actually in high school-ish sort of took control of my own musical inspiration, it would be going really deep into one artist at a time. And like, I want to get every single thing this person ever did. And I want to look at the progression and even the albums that everybody thought was shitty by this person. I would kind of get why they had done this particular thing. And that was just the way that I, as somebody that also had aspirations to create that kind of stuff, would get behind something like that, as opposed to, I only want to hear the best of the best, or have somebody, whether a DJ or somebody else, sort of pick out what would make sense for me next. And I don't know that there's any sort of right or wrong. It's just a matter of what actually amounts to you building an intellectual edifice.
Yeah, I mean, you're speaking to the tension between doing something and appreciating something and the different levels to which you can do either of those things. So, I mean, the common part would be for something that you take seriously or that you love or that you want to understand is that you have to do a lot of that work on your own. And you have to put yourself in a position of making your own judgments and not shirk away from that. And, you know, it could be something as demanding as doing philosophy or trying to understand some writer or doing physics or building something, a whole range of things. But so much to really make progress in it, to own it for yourself, you have to sort of do that activity. You have to make judgments for yourself. You have to explore and figure out where the boundaries are.
There's a quote from the On Thinking for Oneself essay. The man who thinks for himself forms his own opinions and learns the authorities for them only later on, when they serve but to strengthen his belief in them and in himself. But the book philosopher starts from the authorities. He reads other people's books, collects their opinions, and so forms a whole for himself which resembles an automaton made above anything but flesh and blood. Contrarily, he who thinks for himself creates a work like a living man is made by nature. For the work comes into being as a man does. The thinking mind is impregnated from without, and then it forms and bears its child. So I think there's something true about that, but that it's overly simplistic. One of the people that it was David Chalmers that we interviewed said, try to do some philosophy first. So he started as a mathematician, sort of doing philosophy, thinking on his own outside of just, you know, his math that he was studying, and formed some strong beliefs, and then actually did the studying to build it up. And, you know, that seems right. I was definitely, my interest in philosophy and my doing philosophy very naively was back, you know, when I was a kid. And it was only slowly that, and it was because I was reading stuff that was, you know, I was reading the Bible. I was reading the stuff that you have to read in English class and school. And I was forming what seemed like original thoughts to me in reaction to that stuff. I was not reading philosophers. If somebody had taught me, I don't know, I was going to say if somebody taught me Plato at that age, maybe it wouldn't have been good. But Plato is foreign enough that a lot of the philosophy that people start out with, sort of thankfully, is weird and historical. And so it doesn't serve to sort of take you over and you start off as a Plato clone and then you evolve your own thing. Like, nobody can be a Plato clone in this day and age. It's just, that would be ridiculous. And Socrates is so acerbic and by his nature would transcend any attempt for you to imitate him as a starting point.
But not Nietzsche. I mean, yeah, Nietzsche would be the example, right?
I don't know. Does anybody start with Nietzsche? I mean, well, how many
18-year-old undergrads in the past 100 years have read Nietzsche and started, you know, acting like Nietzsche writes?
But isn't usually in that case that it's the reason that they're attracted to Nietzsche is because they have some visceral rebellious reaction against the pablum that they're being served in school. And then they find Nietzsche or Ayn Rand or something like that. And they think, this is my key to liberation, that I've already been a rebel on my own. And this guy is saying what I think. Maybe they're hearing Howard Stern or somebody, any number of self-proclaimed rebels.
Maybe. I mean, it undoubtedly resonates with them in some way. And I'm just reacting to the way in which certain authors, that a student can read somebody and become sort of wholly enamored by them, become a Nietzschean off the bat. And it just, you know, resonates with me from college and from teaching that there are certain authors that some students will become enamored with solely and deeply. And Nietzsche is one of them.
Don't you think, though, that that's a fine stage in intellectual development? I guess I don't see any problem with that. Like, if you really, I don't know, it just seems there's so many ways to do it right. Whereas Schopenhauer has seemingly very black and white. Yeah. You should just be sort of reading off nature. The work should come into being with your thinking mind impregnated from without, right? From nature itself, not from things you're reading.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's two ways of thinking about influence. I think this is what the critic Harold Bloom means by the anxiety of influence, but although I'm not sure, which is the idea that you need influence, right? You need matter. You can't, you know, despite Schopenhauer's emphasis on form, you can't do anything without matter and can't do anything without influence. And the anxiety is that you'll be swallowed up by that influence, that you'll be simply derivative, right? And completely unoriginal. But Mark, as you pointed out, originality is actually built up out of a synthesis of influences. So it is a matter of, you know, the way one responds to influence and whether or not one can do anything creatively with that. And it's a different frame of mind, right? If you're reading Nietzsche and maybe a bunch of other stuff, and in some sense that seeps into your bones a little bit, and then ultimately, maybe it's years later, but something seeps out that shows facets of all these different influences, but also is somehow true to you, right? There's that question of style and character again. It's not, you haven't been overwhelmed. You know, you make use of this motley set of influences in some way. There's a difference between that and someone who's merely a scholar. And I'm not saying a scholar can't be original either. I don't think we can just completely dismiss scholars, but someone who's merely a scholar, or what Schopenhauer calls the man of learning, their orientation toward those texts, and even if they might want to avoid this, they tend to treat them to some extent as authorities, which is not to say that they're not going to question them, but they're authorities in the sense that these are the things to be studied. It's worthwhile in and of itself to write a book tracing the influence of Schopenhauer on Nietzsche, which is the sort of thing Schopenhauer decries, because those men were great. And it's sort of their greatness, I can take that as my matter and treat of it, and that's sufficient. Where for Schopenhauer, of course, no, that's not sufficient. So I think it's different, though, to say I am somehow going to be formally influenced by them. Then not simply treat these former greats as my matter, but somehow integrate them into my form, let's say. So I think Schopenhauer could be reconciled. I think you're right that he puts it too strongly. But I think if pushed, he would have to recognize that influence is important. It's just that there are these two very different ways of seeing influence. One where you integrate it and it doesn't overwhelm you, and the other where it's you take the influence as the sum and substance of what you're doing.
Well, I think the problem is his epistemology is just confused. That he says, again, the genius doesn't just produce original thoughts of his own accord. He says genius can produce original thoughts just as little as a woman by herself can bear children. Outwork circumstances must come to fructify genius and be, as it were, a father to its progeny. So I agree with that. Genius is a matter of, or, you know, any creative act, forget this sort of elitist term, but does that have to just be, as he says, that somehow the genius is reading perennial truth off of nature? I think that's just a confused notion of the way language works, that we are always, when we interpret nature in any way, and maybe it's even sort of a myth to say that there is this languageless nature which we encounter and we apply language to interpret it, that this is all in our experience twisted together. We are primarily linguistic beings, so that the distinction between what we read off of nature and what we read from other authors is not as sharp as he wants to say.
Yeah, but I think he's talking there about having the insight for oneself. So as opposed to reading something that says Kant said this and so-and-so said this, and then you can sort of make clever deductions or have some sort of scholarly thoughts about the relationships between, you know, various thoughts. There's a difference between that, the men who are focused on books, and people who are focused on, he's saying nature, but really it's just focused on the ideas themselves. And so again, it's a difference between saying, I'm going to think this problem through. And, you know, you may, again, I don't think you can avoid influence. There has to be some stimulus, but it's a difference between being presented with Kant and then saying, all right, I'm going to give this a lot of thought before I take the next step, to going into the other mode where you just say, okay, someone explain it to me. Let me go find a book to explain this to me.
Well, the elitism means that he's being very uncharitable, that some of the specific people like Hegel that he criticizes are ones that I think if you read them charitably, you will find, even if they had some bad intellectual habits and you don't like their writing style or something, that there was probably something going on there, that they're not purely charlatans, as you would dismiss them as. And it's funny that, you know, he really distinguishes himself. Oh, all these people like Hegel, they're just the fashion of the day and they'll be forgotten. And I, true genius, will be remembered. Well, no, you're actually both being remembered. So even Fichte is only slightly behind you in terms of long-term notoriety. And people find your book, the hard book, not this book, nearly as difficult. It's a similar taste of reader who likes you and likes Fichte, right, and Hegel as well. Right. So while some of these people that he's pointing out are pure scholars and they never think for themselves, and they're, of course people like that exist, but the serious players probably are not that. And many of the more ordinary looking players are probably not that. And if you kind of talk to them more, you might think that their way of acquiring knowledge actually does make a good deal of sense and is not just this drowning out their original thought with scholarship or crap like that. It's just, I don't find it very useful, this this asshole attitude that he's taking here, you know, that he prides himself on. You have to be an asshole, you have to be arrogant, you have to dismiss 99% of what's around you as all being crap, because that's the way to focus your own creativity and your own, again, it's the situation of not distinguishing between the negative part of your own creative process, that is the things that you dismiss to hone your own work and make it as awesome as possible, not distinguishing between that and being a charitable reader or listener or viewer of a wide variety of different kinds of creation that have different purposes, different structural characteristics, mm-hmm. etc.
Are these our closing statements?
That's pretty okay. Damn close to my closing, yes.
Okay. I enjoyed reading it, and he certainly is fun to read in at least these essays. And, you know, he is a bit cranky, and I think that Mark is right about he makes a virtue of crankiness, which is probably merely just crankiness. But the emphasis on having to own your own thoughts, and that the work of owning your own thoughts is well worth it, and it involves a certain amount of maybe willfully closing off some of the noise and reading in the rest of the world, and to do the activity on your own. Now, it sounds right to me and is well worth reminding oneself of.
I got to throw in that he has another essay that I just read the beginning of, just actually called On Noise, where the whole thing is just a gripe about how noisy things are, particular whip cracking. All this, the people in the street, they just crack their whips all the time, and those people should just be whipped. Even people that they don't even, like, their horse is not even there, and they just walk along cracking their whip because they're in the habit of it. It sounded like he was describing if you live in a neighborhood where there's a lot of gunshots going off, like that I'm very glad that we've outgrown that era of whip cracking.
It also made me think of boomboxes. There was that one decade where you had a gigantic radio that you could carry around with you. Now everybody has their music just in their ears. They have a little private sphere of music.
You still have cars.
Yeah, true.
Actually, if you go to the Maria Popova post on Brain Pickings, and there's some pictures of Schopenhauer there, and he doesn't look like the cranky pessimist that he's reputed to be. I mean, he looks kind of mischievous and amused and very vital, like, and he has this glimmer in his eyes. So I find that very interesting. You know, I wonder how much he really just enjoys the role of the gadfly.
I got to bring one more point up as a way of wrapping up. Just, I can see a lot of people objecting to this whole Schopenhauerian picture of the solitary philosopher who just writes for posterity and doesn't care about his contemporaries as lauding the useless, that ultimately the philosopher is just about getting at, or, you know, like the artist, about getting at perennial truth, is not about coming up with anything that can be practically applied. And that goes part and parcel with just his pessimistic picture of existence, that he really didn't believe in progress. He believed in strict determinism. So people did what they have to do. So by extension, the genius is a genius. You can't just become a genius because you're pursuing correct habits or something like that. Of course, there are things you could neglect, what talents you have. There's lots of choices to be made, but he's very fatalistic. Everybody acts out of their nature, out of their motives that they come to the table with. There is no alternative, no deeper calling than this calling to look within yourself and get in touch with the absolute or the in itself. There's nothing to do. I completely see somebody entirely wanting to discount everything that we've said here about the contemplative life just because they fundamentally object to anything approaching that picture of the world. And I don't think we've said anything here to counter those people. Next time, we'll be discussing two articles by mathematician and philosopher Kurt Gödel, Some Basic Theorems on the Foundation of Mathematics and Their Implications, and The Modern Development of the Foundations of Mathematics in Light of Philosophy. You can look now for more information and a precog for that at partiallyexaminedlife.com. We're supported by your donations. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Please follow our blog, follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook. Go like our Facebook page as opposed to the group that you can join. They're both out there. They're both awesome. I want to remind folks that we have on our page, if you don't want to just donate money directly to us or become a PEL citizen, which will give you many benefits, you can use the Amazon link on our site, which will give us a percentage of anything you buy without it costing you anything additional. So it doesn't have to be philosophy books. It can be anything. So please bookmark our site. And whenever you're going to do any Amazon purchases, please get to it through our site.
Buy your Tesla through our Amazon link.
Yes. All right. Thanks, guys. This is the kind of discussion that I really enjoy, where we're not burdened by the text, where we can go off and be masters of the conversation and not just have to spend the whole time figuring out what the fuck they're talking about.
All right. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Sleep off the fever I've brought on. Sweep off the insects that land on my neck. Clean out my locker of old things. Clean out my head. sex in my head will start to mumble. Sometimes I just don't think it all. Think I do. Yeah.